Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. In this episode, we will meet the founder of a startup company that is working to bring advanced radiotherapy systems to people in low to middle income countries at a fraction of the current cost. She asks if we are doing enough to ensure that the benefits of science reach those who need them the most. But first, does life exist in the clouds of Venus? Earlier this week, a team of astronomers led by Jane Greaves of Cardiff University in the UK announced that a molecule associated with microbial life on Earth has been discovered in the atmosphere of Venus. This came as a surprise because Venus, with its hot, toxic, and high-pressure atmosphere, was not seen as a good place to go looking for extraterrestrial life. To talk about this discovery, I'm joined by the astronomy writer Keith Cooper, who's in Cornwall. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Hamish.
So, Keith, what exactly have astronomers found in the atmosphere of Venus, and why could it be a sign of life?
Well, it's important to stress that they haven't found actual life yet, and they haven't found organic material. What they have found is a gas called phosphine. It's a fairly simple molecule, one atom of phosphorus, three hydrogen atoms. The thing is, on Earth, the only thing that produces phosphine naturally, other than, you know, in factories and things, the only thing that produces it naturally on Earth is life, anaerobic life, like that's life that doesn't breathe oxygen. And so last year, some astronomers led by Clara Souza Silver at MIT realized that phosphine would be a really good biomarker because as the only thing we know that produces it is life, if we found it in the atmosphere of a distant exoplanet, we could say with confidence there's a good chance life is there. We never thought that we'd find it in the atmosphere of a planet in our own solar system. So when, you know, the team led by Jane Greaves looked at Venus, they weren't expecting to find the signature of phosphine. They were really doing it to, you know, set limits on what we might expect to find in exoplanet atmospheres and just to test the equipment and whether it would be sensitive enough to detect phosphine. So they were shocked when they found this strong signal of this gas in Venus's atmosphere. Because as you say, Venus is a hellish planet. Its temperature and pressure is extreme. Sulfuric acid clouds. It's not the kind of place you would expect to find life. But all of a sudden, thanks to this discovery, it's jumped to the top of the list of places in our solar system where we might find life.
And as you said, phosphine is a fairly simple molecule. So why do astronomers not think that it could be made by geological processes on Venus?
Mainly because it isn't made by geological processes on Earth. There's no known geological reaction, chemical reaction that produces it on our planet. And that's why astronomers thought it would be a really good biomarker for Earth-like planets around other stars. The caveat to that is Venus isn't Earth-like. As I described earlier, it's an extreme planet. The surface temperature is 460 degrees Celsius. The surface atmospheric pressure is 93 bar. We have the clouds of sulfuric acid, a thick atmosphere filled with carbon dioxide. And it is possible that there could be some unknown geological or geochemical reaction going on near the surface that could be producing this that just doesn't happen on Earth. But at the moment, because the only source of phosphine, natural source of phosphine on Earth is life, then we have to take that hypothesis seriously for Venus.
And I know it's early days. The paper describing this discovery was only published earlier this week. But has there been any speculation about what forms of life could exist in the clouds of Venus? Are we talking about, you know, sort of tiny bacteria-like creatures that float around? I mean, what are people saying about that?
Yeah, if there is life on Venus, it's going to be microbial. We're not talking about little green men or bug-eyed monsters. Certainly not complex, intelligent life. You know, over the years, the Soviet Union sent a number of probes into Venus's atmosphere, some that landed on the surface. And as they plunged down through the depths of Venus's atmosphere, they detected strange particles in the air that some scientists speculated could be some kind of microbe. It was just supposition, you know, it wasn't a very serious hypothesis without extra data. But also in Venus's atmosphere is this strange unknown material that absorbs ultraviolet light. So when we take a picture of Venus in ultraviolet, we see these dark areas stretched across the atmosphere, and there's some material in the atmosphere that is absorbing ultraviolet light. And again, this has been speculated that maybe it could be some kind of microbial life that is absorbing the ultraviolet for energy. But again, you know, that's kind of circumstantial. But now that we have this phosphine detection, you know, maybe we can start to join the dots and say that these are possibly connected. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, it could still be some unknown geochemical reaction. So we have to be cautious when we talk about whether this is life or not. But it's a strong indicator that there could be something there.
And in terms of resolving this, I mean, I suppose that certain things can be done here on Earth. You know, chemists and astrobiologists can go into the lab and see if there is a way of making phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. I'm guessing that sort of thing is going to be front and center here on Earth in terms of research.
Definitely. I mean, it's quite funny actually that I was speaking to Jane Greaves, who led this research last week, and she was making the point that we haven't really done that much modeling of Venus's atmosphere on Earth, you know, in terms of whether life could survive there, because nobody really thought it could. And also, you know, when some of these reactions, when you mix phosphorus and hydrogen, can be quite explosive. So nobody wants to blow their lab up. So we haven't done much work in that regard. You know, when they were trying to work out the reaction rates for their paper, you know, they had scant data to go on and scant previous results. So again, you know, that's another reason to perhaps be a little bit cautious. But, you know, on Venus, I described this planet as a hellish planet. But there is actually a region in the atmosphere about 50 to 60 kilometers above the surface where, you know, the temperature is somewhat similar to the temperature on the surface of Earth. The pressure is similar to the atmospheric pressure on the surface of Earth. So, I won't say that it would be a nice place to live, because we still don't understand how life could survive, you know, the clouds made of 95% sulfuric acid, and there's very little water present as well. But, you know, there is a region there that could perhaps be conducive to some kind of extremophile life, an extremophile microbe being a microbe that can survive in extreme conditions. The only way to know for sure will be to go back and to really explore this region of Venus's atmosphere. And, you know, we haven't landed on Venus since 1985. We've sent a few probes that have orbited Venus, and they've been able to look through the thick clouds with radar to map the surface, or maybe they're mapping, you know, the rotation or circulation in the atmosphere. We haven't really gone down into the atmosphere yet. NASA are looking at a mission called Da Vinci Plus, which would drop a probe into the atmosphere of Venus and could, you know, potentially look for this phosphine. And there's even been, you know, suggestions that we could have some kind of flying wing, you know, that we deploy into Venus's atmosphere and happily glides around the planet in this habitable region 50 to 60 kilometers above the surface. And I think with this discovery, you know, those kind of missions are going to start to become first and foremost in, you know, the minds of space agencies and scientists.
I suppose that's a real challenge with Venus in particular, because it has such a thick atmosphere. It must be very difficult to, you know, to actually see anything. Is that a problem?
It is. We know very little about Venus's surface. You know, we have a few pictures that the Soviet probes beamed back to Earth before the, you know, the acidic, high temperature, high pressure conditions eroded their circuits and caused them to fail after an hour or two. And, you know, we only saw, you know, the vicinity of the landing site. What we do know about the surface has come from infrared and radar studies. So, you know, we have good maps of the surface. But in terms of its composition, I mean, there was just a report a few months ago about, you know, new evidence that there seems to still be some kind of volcanic activity on Venus. But we didn't know about that until recently. So there's still so much that we don't know. And perhaps the more that we investigate Venus now, you know, we'll start to pick up new clues that we'll be able to explain this phosphine mystery and whether it is life or whether it is a new geochemical reaction. And if it is the latter, if it isn't life, then that's also important for when we're looking for life elsewhere on planets around other stars. Because if we're detecting phosphine there, we need to know, is it definitely life or could it be something else? It's analogous to the mystery of the Mars methane. On Mars, there's these mysterious plumes of methane that seem to be seasonal. We don't know what's causing them. Is it geology? Is it biology? And we really don't know. And at the moment, this phosphine mystery on Venus kind of falls into that category, although, you know, I would say it's leaning a little bit towards life than not life. But, you know, that's still with the caveats that I mentioned. But I'm hopeful.
You can read more about this remarkable discovery in an article that Keith has written on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, "Has Evidence of Life Been Found in the Clouds of Venus?" Thanks for being on the podcast, Keith.
Thank you.
Radiotherapy is crucial for the treatment of many cancers, but it can be very difficult to access for people living in low to middle income countries. Providing wider access is the goal of Empower RT, a social enterprise founded by the medical physicist Sha Chang. In the upcoming segment, Chang and her Empower colleague CL Collins are in conversation with Physics World's Tammy Freeman.
I'm talking today to Empower RT, a startup company spun out of the University of North Carolina's Medical Physics Department. The company is working to bring advanced radiotherapy systems to developing countries at a fraction of the current cost. With me today are Sha Chang, the company's founder and president, and CL Collins, head of outreach for Empower RT. So Sha, what was your motivation for setting up the company?
I was actually inspired by a student that I never met. About 4 years ago, I heard a story online told by Jiang He, a biology PhD graduate. He told this story during his speech in the Harvard University graduation commencement. And this is a story about a spider bite. He grew up in a really remote countryside farmland in China, where there's no electricity, no telephone, no modern, just really remote village. When he was playing in the field, he was bitten by a poison spider. Then he ran back home to his mom, and his mom wrapped his hand with cotton and soaked with cooking wine. And then his mother set his hand on fire. It was excruciating pain. And then after maybe a minute, his mother extinguished the fire. This folk remedy actually worked because heat deactivates protein, which is what the poison is made of. So later on, when he went to university, then later on came to the United States, he asked the question that I know that a better, less painful, and safer treatment existed. Why didn't I receive one at that time? So in the commencement speech to all the Harvard graduates, he asked, how could I bring the meaning of research and development to the public? And how can I benefit more people? So his story really inspired me to think differently and ask different questions, because I have been an academic medical physicist for decades. So the different questions are the how have we been more wasteful with the knowledge we have, with the technologies we have, than with paper and plastic that we recycle regularly now? And did our inventions have enough impact where they are needed most in the world? How can I create more impact with what I have invented, what I have done already at UNC? You know, we all want to live a meaningful life and to have positive impact to the world, but it doesn't have to be the biggest thing. There are many ways to make impact, bringing what we already know and have in the US to the less developed part of the world and stop the burning hand for spider bite type of high toxicity treatments is making a real impact. This is the reason why I founded Empower RT, which is a social enterprise. So for people who are not very familiar with the business model, one definition of social enterprise is an organization that uses business engine to make social change in the world.
Okay, that's great. And specifically, your company's working to bring radiotherapy systems to developing countries.
Correct. More and more people are aware there is a huge cancer care disparity, including in radiation therapy in the world. In the next 20 years, you know, cancer mortality rate is expected to decrease by 30% in developed countries. In the next, you know, 20 years, the cancer mortality rate in the less developed countries are projected to increase more than 70%. This is NIH data. About 75% of all cancer death may occur in the low and middle income countries. And this is really sad truth, because many of those cancer patients in developing countries die and suffer, not because the world doesn't know how to treat those cancers. We don't know how to effectively treat several cancers, but we know how to do it for many cancers. They die and suffer because they have no access to the treatment, including the access to the radiation therapy treatments. And this is the global cancer, you know, disparity. I believe the solution that relies on what the developing countries currently do not have, for example, lack of resource means money, infrastructure, etc. Solutions rely on what they don't have. Perhaps it's not going to work well, at least on a large scale. Like farmers, they only grow crops that the local environments allow. If your land is dry, you grow drought-resistant crops. You don't grow water-loving vegetables, right? So, you know, our mission is to help people in low-resource countries to improve the quality of radiation therapy using existing resources, you know, without spending millions of dollars that they don't have.
Right. So before we look in detail at the products that Empower RT is developing, can I just ask Ciel, what were your reasons for joining the company?
Yeah. So I was actually at a conference in China that Shaw was invited to speak about Empower RT. And the first time that I heard her speak, I was so excited. I was, you know, in graduate school at the time, and I was learning so much about medical physics and everything going on in our country in graduate school. But, you know, after hearing her speak, I was given this more broad perspective and worldview, and I was confronted with what a huge disparity there is around the world in radiation therapy and cancer care. And I just felt how important this work is, how needed it is, and how much I really wanted to be doing it and participating. And, you know, I feel like in this field, we pour so many resources and research into innovation at any cost. And I was really drawn to the challenge of accessibility, you know, like Shah just said, doing more with less. And the Empower RT solution in her talk was so feasible, yet comprehensive at the same time. And I instantly believed in it, and I really wanted to help. And, you know, I'm just overall really drawn to global cancer care because I don't think that we can, as a field, be truly successful until everyone has access, you know, eliminating some of those staggering statistics that Shah talked about a few minutes ago.
What exactly is the company doing to address this problem? What are you developing?
We bring feasible and already clinical proven IMRT solution to developing countries.
So just for the benefit of the listeners, IMRT is intensity modulated radiotherapy, and it's quite an advanced way of delivering radiotherapy. So how are you achieving this then?
Yes, most people know of IMRT, that is as an automated treatment planning, a treatment approach using digital technology. We developed this particular recyclable compensator IMRT solution actually many years ago, before MLC-based, which is multi-leaf collimator-based digital treatment approach. We developed this technology before the commercial MLC technologies became available. What's good about this is that when we develop this recyclable compensator IMRT technology, which include software, hardware, and also the hand-down fabrication processes, we develop manual operation environment that is still used in many low resource settings. So we know this technology is feasible in that environment.
Okay, and this is the compensator that shapes the radiation beams to match the patient's tumor, yeah.
In addition to this already clinical proven compensated MRT, we also develop a, we call it eChart system, which is a recording verify system for manual operation clinic to improve their clinical flow and also patient safety aspect.
Okay, and would your products be deployed? So say a center in a developing country has got a really basic radiotherapy system. Could you use your products to turn it into a more advanced treatment system, sort of more precise treatments?
Yes, you know, that's the key. The compensated MRT, the conversion of the uniform radiation to we call the intensity modulated radiation. We do it by a use of a simple box. Okay. In the box, there are the conversion occurs. So this box can be inserted to any radiation producing machine. So that's the beauty of it. Using this approach, we can make all the radiation therapy machines, the low and middle income countries, to produce a more advanced radiation therapy treatment.
Okay, and I guess that's going to be better for the patients because they're getting a more precision treatment, less side effects, etc. So does Empower RT also offer training to help clinics set up this new system?
Yes, In PowerRT, we actually, we called offered four-pronged solution that include the treatment planning software, the hardware for compensator fabrication, and service and training. Training is crucial. Doesn't matter if it's using our technology or state-of-art technology. Training is crucial. Not only that it's important to make the most benefit of the solution, the other question is definitely is patient safety. So we do extensive training online and also on site. What EmpowerRT is focusing on is indicated by its name. We are a company, we're not focused on selling products. We really focus on empowerment of the people in low resource setting clinics to empower people so they are more capable, they are more independent. Training, extensive training is a must.
Okay. And I gather EmpowerRT has installed its first system now at the Cancer Diseases Hospital in Zambia. So what did that process entail?
Zambia has a population of, I think, 14 or 16 million. There's only one cancer hospitals in the country, which is a cancer disease hospital. They have three basic radiation therapy machines, none of them before we came capable of IMRT. So we offer training and weekly remote training on our treatment planning software. And we went to Zambia three times, do on-site training for everybody, hand-down training, and doing dry runs, several dry runs before, you know, go live. And the training is we focus on knowledge transfer and retention. When we train the trainer. Then we watch the trainer train others. And we do this for radiation oncologists, medical physics, and RTTs, or radiation therapy technicians. In Zambia, there is no dosimetrist. Okay, so we have to adapt what the structure is, what's available to do the training.
Okay, and how's that going now? Have they treated any patients there yet, do you know?
We would have treated perhaps two times. It's because of unexpected challenges that in Zambia. Number one, their machine broke down. It took a very long time because of lack of resources to repair the machine. Okay, so that was delayed, the first patient treatment. And the second, there was unexpected challenges. We couldn't treat it as well, even when the patient's on the table. And the last patient we try, and the machine broke again because we are in a COVID pandemic and the repair is delayed because foreigners right now, my understanding is, cannot enter Zambia because in this pandemic period. Yeah, so there is the good thing is that we overcame many unexpected challenges. So even we did not complete one patient treatment, the Zambia team from doctors, physicists, and also the RTTs, they all learned a great deal. They are confident that they can do the procedure independently by themselves with us remotely doing the review and monitoring. And so that's what's the, you know, the success. We have a technology we know well that it works well in the United States, in this kind of a high income country environment. And in this first implementation, we are testing not only if Zambia people can use it, like it, we also test EmpowerRT's ability to provide it.
What's next? Do you have another installation planned? I know everything's a bit up in the air, obviously, with the pandemic at the moment, but do you have another site scheduled?
Yes. Now we know a great deal more that how to make a technology, even if it's feasible, even if it's simple, how do we actually do the process? So we are talking to cancer clinics in Nigeria and also Indonesia. And we're also, you know, continuing to strengthen our partnerships, like with CHAI, which is Clinton Health Access Initiative, which has 4 decades of experience in developing countries. You know, they can be the foot on the ground for us. And also Rare Control Cancer, a group that focuses on training in radiation therapy around the world.
Yeah, to add to that a little bit, I think one of the exciting things about our focus on building relationships and partnerships is that a lot of groups with similar focuses are, especially during the times of COVID, working very virtually, doing virtual training, working online. And one of the most valuable things that I think EmpowerRT can use to strengthen other groups and strengthen relationships is Shaw's experience on site and the amount of time she spent. And as she talks about the bottom 90% of the iceberg, she really knows a lot of the pitfalls and unexpected challenges that you can experience in these settings. And a lot of groups, you know, through some of our talking have found that to be very valuable to have someone like her and the group at EmpowerRT working with them to help them just because of that experience that she has with all of the challenges because she works so hands-on and on-site and the whole EmpowerRT team does.
Thanks, Shah and Ciel, for taking the time to speak with me today. It's been great to talk to you both about the important work that your company's doing. You can read more about the radiotherapy technologies being developed by EmpowerRT on the Physics World website in the article, Advanced Radiotherapy at a Fraction of the Cost.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Sha Chang, Ciel Collins, Keith Cooper, and Tammy Freeman for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.